Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series. In the first of three programs examining various aspects of the Amazon, our speaker will be Ryan Valdez, a research fellow at the Smithsonian National Zoological Park. His topic will be Amazon conservation. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, June 24, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
Our guest this evening is Ryan Valdez, currently a research fellow at the Smithsonian's National Zoological Park in the Center for Biodiversity and Conservation, Education, and Sustainability. He is also pursuing a Ph.D. Environmental conservation to study the effects of land use on wildlife in northern Kenya. For nearly 7 years prior to this, he was the program director of the Smithsonian's Amazon GIS project and remains a research staff member at the National Zoo. He travels throughout the Amazon and his associations with the conservation communities throughout the Latin America and the U.S. have provided him with insight to the future of Amazon conservation. Tonight, Ryan will discuss the eight-country region of the Amazon that contains the greatest concentration of biodiversity anywhere on Earth, conserving its resources while simultaneously accommodating sustainable development has become one of the greatest conservation challenges we face. Ladies and gentlemen, Ryan Valdez.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I hope everyone can hear me okay back there. Mick Hale and Leo Smith, thank you very much for your welcome at the Durham Museum. You should be very proud of this facility. I'm very impressed with it, and I think you have some incredibly visionary members of the community here. So I'm really honored to be here, and the impetus actually for my interest in wildlife ecology and pursuing academics came from this area with the likes of Marlon Perkins and Jim Fowler, the Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. So it's nice to be back, in a sense. Today, what I want to share with you is a place that is very special to me, and of course to many others. It is one of the largest, it is the largest intact tropical forest in the world. And it's highly important for a lot of reasons. I will go through them slowly and hopefully share some good information there with you. This is a place that's expelling 209,000 cubic meters of water per second, more than the other three rivers of the world combined, three largest rivers. The magnitude of this area is so impressive. You can fit the entire continental United States in the Amazon basin. Amazonia is made up of eight nations. If you consider French Guiana, then that would be a ninth. And you've got two coastal areas. And of course, you have this really incredible feature here, the Andes Mountains, which weren't there all the time. And the reason why we have this incredible region of the Amazon is because of a lot of non-living factors. You've got time, water, and temperature that created the foundation for the world's most biodiverse region. The Amazon used to flow out this end, but something in here occurred. The Nazca and Cocos plates collided with the South America plate. Once those two plates collided and created the Andes, you now have land above the water, and it slowly changed the rest of it from there on. So if you think about interesting creatures like river dolphins and freshwater stingrays and species whose origins are from a marine environment, some of this geography starts to play a role. It's also nice to have sort of a perspective of, again, the immense landscape involved here. The Amazon is 7.5 million square kilometers. So a colossal region. And nearly 80% of that is still intact forest. So when you think of the Amazon, you think of the Amazon community, I really want you to keep in mind that this is a place of incredible hope, incredible opportunity, and it still holds the world's most biodiverse resources. Of course, why is Amazonia important? Biodiversity is important for a lot of other reasons as well, but just containing multiple species is important. You have over 1,000 bird species, more than 500 mammal species. The list goes on and on. But why is it important to have lots of species? So what? Well, the interconnectedness of these species with each other and with the plant community, with the abiotic community, there's a lot of hidden treasures in there. Just the genetics alone is an incredibly valuable resource. There's so much that we don't know about the Amazon. But these species all working together in a community are what form an ecological service. This is what keeps a lot of clean water, a quarter of the world's fresh water. This is what's helping us to maintain some quality of air. You have the world's largest contiguous forest here, so carbon sequestration is going to play a big role. This forest is a filter. So ecological services is a part of the bioliteracy that I would like you to get accustomed to. You're going to hear it more and more often. Culturally, Amazonia is very diverse and very complicated. You have 8 nations. You've at least 400 indigenous intact tribes representing about 4 million people. And in the middle of all that, you have a lot of hybrid communities, new communities. Some people call them squatters. There's all kinds of names going out there about these small villages that pop up overnight. So sociologically, the Amazon is a very, very complicated place. A lot of different languages, a lot of different cultures. So it is not an easy thing to deal with. You may have seen recently there's some controversy over the possibility of having found a new uncontacted tribe. But these groups, some of these groups are discovered every year. Whether or not they're uncontacted, that's a hard thing to justify. But it does tell us something, that there are still people living in the forest, in harmony with the forest, in small groups. And hopefully you will have the opportunity to meet one of the world's finest ethnobotanists. I really do hope that he makes it here. His name is Mark Plotkin. He is a shaman that's a medicine man, and he works with all the tribal groups throughout the Amazon. He runs an organization called the Amazon Conservation Team in Washington, D.C. And this gentleman is just phenomenal. If you get to hear the stories of what he's been through the last 25 years living with local peoples in all the countries of the Amazon, it's truly incredible. So I sympathize, because Mark protects the Amazon by protecting people. Where you have indigenous groups, you tend to have intact forest communities. You don't have roads. You don't have illegal logging. So where these guys are present, they're protecting the forest. So part of Mark's endeavor is to empower these people. And as you can see, they have come a long way. They have voices now. They have people that represent them and help them. And I find it really difficult when we're sitting at a big, World Bank Association meeting, and indigenous peoples are often not part of the mix. But that is changing, certainly through the Inter-American Development Bank. Amazonia is also very important because this is a massive hydrological cycle that's intact. This is an intact watershed. Now, there's a lot of misconception that the rain and water generated in the Amazon returns to the Amazon, but that's not true. A lot of it actually goes south to the Sao Paulo region, where a lot of agriculture is. So think about this association for a moment. If you have all this agricultural industry south of the Amazon, it's depending on the water resources from the Amazon. It might be economically beneficial to protect the watershed in the Amazon so that you can continue to feed these crops and agriculture. So water, a very big deal for South America. Stabilizing streams and rivers. There is a colossal network of riparian systems throughout the Amazon basin that are working in harmony. Of course, you know what dams and development projects can do to some of these. We've seen a lot of evidence of this in the United States in the southern Florida watershed and other areas. It takes a lot more money to reverse this damage. So hopefully being proactive about these things is really important. And the Amazonia as a whole entity has that opportunity to be proactive and protect these cycles. Carbon. We've all heard about carbon, but it's important that you know where carbon is headed. Having carbon in your country, if you're a third world country, is incredibly important because this is a new kind of currency. Carbon sequestration, carbon credits, these are things that are talked about quite frequently at the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, and international organizations. With carbon, what we have been doing in the last few hundred years is just changing where it is. The same amount has always been here. But when you burn a tree, you take that carbon from the tree, and now you've put it into the atmosphere. That is what's really causing these global climate changes. So it's just sort of that reallocation of where the carbon is. If we could put it back under the ground, or if there was a way to monitor and more closely control how that's dispersed, it would help. But this is a very, very hot topic in the Amazon, and countries that have large intact forests, they have really great opportunities now. Debt for nature swap is one of them. Trying to define, though, where the Amazon is a tough thing. So I'll show you the two most basic polygons, if you will, of where Amazonia is. This is your traditional, this yellow boundary is your traditional geologic watershed boundary. And all that really means is a drop of water outside the basin will flow in some other river outside the basin. A drop of water inside will eventually end up in the Amazon and out the mouth of the Amazon. So trying to delineate exactly where that is a tough job. And it's not concrete yet on a lot of these borders. But that's your standard definition, and that's what's 7.5 million square kilometers. However, Amazonia is, of course, not going to operate in such a simple, logical format. You've got eight nations working together. So they've created a group called the Amazon Cooperation Treaty. And this group has a much bigger polygon that go all the way up to places where they're not actually part of the watershed. But that's okay, because at least it's a start. This is one way for these nations to come together and identify their own boundaries. Technically, only Brazil and Colombia have identified their Amazon borders, but the other countries have not technically. We still know where those are, however. So there are big groups working at this, and in 2005, you had the Amazon Cooperation Treaty Organization working with the European Commission and IUCN just on defining where Amazonia is. It's still a very tricky question. But this publication exists if anyone is interested. And I want to make recognition of this group. It's the only group of its kind in South America that represent all nations of the Amazon. But having this in existence is a huge success. This group is able to bring nations together where otherwise they would never come together. There are a lot of border disputes and national disputes. But in a forum like this, you can sit together on a table, look at maps, and talk about the future of Amazonia. So I think it's important to recognize that this exists. So I'm going to quickly just go through these countries, maybe point out a few things here and there. Brazil, of course, being the powerhouse, 60% of its national territory is in the Amazon basin. But if you've seen a map of Brazil, it goes quite far south. But these states in the north are the more unexplored areas. This is really what's called the arc of deforestation. If you go to Google Maps or some other service and you zoom into this area, you're going to see a difference in color. Now, a lot of that is geologic because these are the highlands, but this is where deforestation is slowly encroaching into the Amazon basin. Bolivia, if you've seen the latest National Geographic magazine, there's a great article in there on the Altiplano area of Bolivia. Bolivia has a huge territory in the Amazon. And keep in mind that the Amazon goes right up to the watershed boundary. So you may have snow in the Amazon. You may have glacier ice in the Amazon. Because a drop of water here is eventually going to end up in that Amazon River. So the boundary goes all the way up into the highlands of the Andes. Colombia, this is a very diverse country. This competes with Peru as far as having the most biodiverse regions of the world. Both Peru and Colombia share that title. However, because of the proximity to Panama, Colombia boasts more species of birds and other organisms. And because you have this complex mountain chain that is actually quite unique, this is also feeding into why it is so incredibly biodiverse. And Colombia has a stunning Amazon region, which is huge and very unexplored. And a lot of this area is where you have these spectacular flooded forests. You'll find stilted homes. You know, seasonally, you'll have trees that are just completely covered with water. So a very unique environment. Ecuador, in comparison to a lot of the other countries, of course, smaller, but half of its territory still in the Amazon basin, very intact. And because of its association, of course, with the Galapagos, Ecuador has some very unique biodiverse elements to it. But for Amazon, a serious contender. And this country, among others, is really tapping into the ecotourism industry. So there's some unique qualities here. Guyana and these northern Guyana Shield countries. Actually, none of this territory, the water in this area, goes into the Amazon. It's north of the boundary. But what happens right outside the Amazon affects what's right inside the Amazon. And this area is, I would say that this, we're talking about a 95% intact tropical forest nation. Spectacular natural resources, but very inaccessible. Hard to get down here, and a lot of indigenous groups in here. So I see this as one of the real last frontiers for true wild lands in Amazonia. Peru is a huge, huge country, and little did we know that 75% of it is in the Amazon basin. So major contender. And the foothills of the Andes, because of the elevation gradient, gives it its biodiverse range. Because you have that elevation, you have different critters living at different levels. And of course, this is where most of the rain is. Strangely enough, this is all concessioned out to foreign countries for oil and extractive reserves. So as much as we want to be excited about the natural resources here, we have to be realistic and know that, you know, economics is a big thing here for foreign countries and exporting timber and other things. Suriname, similar to French Guiana, 100% of it considered in the Amazon Cooperation Treaty, but none of the water really coming down to the Amazon, but virtually unexplored. Spectacular place. Venezuela has a small Amazon basin, but one of the most unique geographic places on Earth, where you have these tepuis and the llanos, and if you want to go and find an anaconda, this is where you would do it. A lot of people do. But this is a truly spectacular nation and economic powerhouse. So when they sit at the table, you want to listen. So really, what's happening to the Amazon? I'm going to give you some large titles, share some things with you here. First, we all know about deforestation and logging. And if you want a quick estimate, you know, we're looking at between 14,000 and 20,000 square kilometers per year. But this is a very, very hard thing to define. It depends on when you ask and who you ask. So it fluctuates quite a lot. But nevertheless, it's still up there. We're a bit higher now in 2008. But this is still a very, very big deal, of course. Slash and burn agriculture, we've all heard of this. This is very small scale. But when you expand it to thousands and thousands of people, it's sort of a insidious threat to the Amazon ecosystem because it just slowly changes the face of the Amazon. Hard to notice sometimes, but it's there. So it must be recognized. Pasture fire is still the easiest way to clear land for crops and agriculture and other things, but the fire and the smoke is a problem. Large-scale ranching, a bigger problem, especially the illegal large-scale ranching. There's a lot of illegal activity, but it takes place in the Amazon because it's very hard to enforce things there. How are you going to get to this area? And before you know it, it's after the fact, the wood is gone. So this is a classic example of where's the carbon gone? When you're looking at a tree, half of that tree is basically pure carbon. So we are moving carbon right here. If it ends up in floors or in furniture, at least it's still in wood. But our concern on a global climate level is that it ends up in the atmosphere. So concern here, where is that going? But you may say, well, there's still a lot of forest in here, and yes, that's true. But the forest in between these roads is significantly altered now. Microclimates, whether or not they have large mammals, there's going to be a multitude of things that are now completely different because of this activity. So the ecological balance inside all of this is now changed. Soy has now surpassed cattle as far as removing Amazon forests and altering Amazon landscapes. And what is a little concerning is that originally the soy production was fairly far south in South America, in Brazil mostly. But with new technologies and changing landscapes, soy is moving north and moving into the Amazon basin. So you may think, okay, well, you know, I'm being environmentally friendly, I'm going to eat soy products. Well, this contributes to that. It's very difficult now. I mean, where do you go? You can't eat meat, you can't eat soy. A lot of this soy, however, is used to feed cattle that we then eat. So, very changing arena, but nevertheless, soy is now number one as far as altering landscapes and destroying forests. So changing patterns of forest loss, we have effects that are going on that need to be addressed. One of those is the impact of roads and highways on forest communities. A lot of research has been done through Smithsonian to understand the relationship of mammals and roads. And the general rule of thumb is the larger the mammal, the further away it's going to be from a road. So think about all the species of mammals, 500 plus in the Amazon basin, and the effects that these have on those mammals. What do the mammals do for the forest community? Think of pollination and seed dispersal and all these multitude of things. So a significant impact. Roads, mammals, negative inverse relationship. These are some regression analysis just to kind of demonstrate that this relationship does indeed exist. Where you have highways, you have deforestation. Where you have roads, you have deforestation. Common knowledge, but most of science is really kind of common knowledge. You just have to use the principles of science to say it statistically so that you can say, oh, this is significant. So it is significant, the relationship here. We're just not saying it. We're demonstrating that it does exist. This comes from STRI, from a researcher named Bill Lawrence, and he does a lot of monitoring of roads. The Amazon has become a huge beltway of roads and highways and networks. And now you can drive, you know, from Panama down to Patagonia and back in all kinds of different directions. So a lot of roads making their way much closer to the river. And you can see some of the areas that are relatively untouched. And that is because of water levels and seasonal cycles and whatnot. But it's just a matter of time before they figure out a way around that as well. A lot of new roads. Oil and gas development, as important as this is for the economy of Amazon nations, it's a very damaging element, of course. Now, if we had more responsible organizations that worked in this sector that would remove the roads after they were gone, this would be fantastic. Because the Amazon, one of the best things about the Amazon is that it is super resilient. You just give it a little time, and it'll come back. And once it does, the animals return. But once you leave a road and you no longer use it, that road's not going anywhere. It's going to stay there, and people are going to use it more and more and build roads off of that. So I think a responsible action for this sector is, of course, to have that contingency plan. What happens when you're gone? What are you going to do now? So we look at Shell Oil and Conoco and Exxon and Repsol and all these big oil companies. Now think about how much money it takes to destroy a road. And that may tell you why they don't do it. Just again, to kind of show you that this entire area here, the entire foothills of the Andes, are all concessioned out to oil and gas. There's no space left. So it's just a matter of time as to when they're going to come in and extract those, how they're going to do it. And we actually have an organization within our zoo, the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., that's working with the oil and gas development sector in the Peruvian Amazon, in the northern Peruvian Amazon in the state of Loreto. And we have this unique opportunity to get there before anything is touched, so we can find out significantly what really happens before and after you bring in all these roads and infrastructure. Hopefully, though, we can help influence the way they take action in there. Synergism. So there are things that are happening when they come together that were unexpected. One is that rainfall changes a lot. It's old data, but it's exact same for the last decade. So we have no idea what the rain is going to be like next year. That's uncommon. This is not a good thing. Fire. What does smoke do to a forest community and mammal community? Same thing in Brazil. And very significant relationship between roads and fires. You overlap the two of them, they usually line up. Now, fire is not very natural to the Amazon. You'd have to have a very catastrophic event to really cause a natural fire. So I would say virtually all the fire that we see in the basin of the Amazon is because of humans. So this is a new thing. Trees, animals are not evolved and have not adapted with fire. Unlike where we are now, unlike East Africa, unlike places in Australia, where you do have a lot of natural fires and the animal and plant communities grow and evolve with them. This is not the case in Amazonia. So when a fire breaks out, it's a huge deal. Destroys everything. Defoliation, the removal of vegetation, leaves, grasses, etc. So how do we monitor this stuff? Again, there is great hope in the Amazon. It's still 80% intact. It's a massive region. There's lots of opportunity. One of the best ways to do that is through remote sensing or satellite imagery. Or if there are any GIS folks in the audience, these new technological tools are just fantastic. Now, these are just an image of U.S. satellites, but there are about 600 non-military U.S. satellites orbiting, monitoring everything about the Earth, the climate and hot spots and temperature and ocean currents and you name it. Our GPS satellites, of course, are geostationary, so they're thousands of miles away. But these guys are right above the atmosphere, so they're monitoring very closely. And there are a lot of different kinds of techniques we can use. There's multi-spectral scanners, photographic imagery, there's LIDAR, there's radar, there's so many different kinds of ways to monitor from remote distance. So if anyone is really interested in computer technology, you love geography, you're committed to conservation, this is the future. Remote sensing and geographic information systems, or geographic information sciences. And when you're working with an Amazon basin that's 7.5 million square kilometers, you need these big tools. You've all used Google. You know how cool that is and how easy it is. But consider that you can have, you know, a couple hundred other satellites to choose from to manipulate and to do data analysis on. So a really, really great thing. And if anyone has a GIS degree, you're guaranteed a job. No problem. So very quickly, the kinds of data that you can get, of course, that are important for Amazon conservation, things like airfields, roads, mining, oil, gas, infrastructure. We do a lot of mapping of protected areas, of course, and you know, different colors represent the different countries. One of the largest national parks in the world is right on the Suriname border. This has just doubled in size. Of course, it's a fairly undisturbed area with no enforcement and no protection, but small steps. Ecoregions, which is really developed through Eric Dinerstein at World Wildlife Fund, can tell you the classification. This is sort of, very similar to life zones that were created much earlier. Geotectonic data, geographic data, rainfall. You can seam images together to create these massive mosaics. You can use no imagery at all. Just use elevation data and give it color value to create digital elevation models. These, of course, are emphasized just for the effect. But I love DEMs because you can see just fantastic features under the water. You know, we've got ground-penetrating radar. There's so many fantastic tools to really make interesting relationships with the environment. And, of course, just spectral imagery. There are all kinds of tools, of course, three-dimensional tools. We use a lot of 3D stuff to monitor fires in Southern California. So this is just kind of one of those examples. But we can do this for every part of the Amazon. And we can also associate anything with this technology. So you can be looking at certain kinds of trees, certain kinds of forests, river systems, perhaps uncontacted tribal areas, you name it. It can be mapped. It can be monitored. It can be researched. Very important technological tools. Now, Google is a fantastic visual tool, but if you want to actually use GIS data to do any research on the Amazon so that you can help the future of the Amazon basin, this is probably the world's only repository of data of its kind. This was developed by Smithsonian, NASA, National Geographic Society, University of Maryland, a lot of other partners. Very, very good site to look at. It's focused on conservation data, but you can go to any part of the world, zoom in, and start building your own map, changing the layers, changing the color. So there are a number of people that I think are really important to mention in my experiences in throughout the Amazon. Now, these are folks on the U.S. side, but I do want to address them because this is significant. If you're studying the Amazon, the future of the Amazon, conservation of the Amazon, the one foremost name that should come up is Thomas Lovejoy. This man is a pioneer in Amazon conservation and in tropical ecology. Debt for Nature Swap was created because of him. Basically coined the term biodiversity. You know, he created the science division for World Wildlife Fund. This is a guy who works endlessly at trying to save the Amazon rainforest, working with all eight nations, but does so both at a ground level with research and at a political level with national heads of state. Really impressive guy. It's been an absolute honor to know him and learn from him. I told you about Mark. Mark is just a fantastic guy. You've got to meet him one day or hear one of his presentations so he can share with you the stories of having spent much time in the jungle with indigenous groups. Again, Mark protects indigenous peoples as a way to protect the Amazon. So my hat goes off to him. Dan Nepstad at Woods Hole Research Center out of Boston. is an expert in land change, land cover, but his specialty really is monitoring fires and the associated changes with that throughout the Amazon basin. Dan, very important, of course, at the tables of the World Bank and Inter-American Development Bank and so on. Extraordinarily well published and just a fantastic guy. Really nice work with him. Bill Lawrence, out of the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama, frequents the Amazon, does incredible research on biodiversity, but also this is a guy that studies roads. What do roads do? What's the impact that they have on these communities? And he's also interested in timber industry and the impacts of fire and so on. And I want to mention Janine Freddy, who's the head of the environment for the Inter-American Development Bank. And this is a really incredible woman who is able to cooperatively, you know, bring people together throughout the Amazon, sit at the table of the Amazon Cooperation Treaty, and discuss the future of the Amazon. Just a real mover and shaker in the World Bank culture. Very, very impressive. So I want to leave some things behind in conclusion, and I want you to kind of keep in mind that when you think of the Amazon, though, you really need to step back and look at it at a regional perspective. It's not the same as 50 years ago when you could go in there and discover the tapir and, you know, have a big article in the Geographic and that would do wonders. Species are still being discovered, but the rate of change in the Amazon is so fast that those in itself don't do the job. You need to operate at a larger scale. So recognizing that the scale and rate of change is increasing in the Amazon is of utmost importance at a regional level. Not recognizing this is a dangerous kind of ignorance. These synergistic and unintended effects, it's very important to recognize these. One good example of what's come about through burning of trees or release of carbon is what's called photosynthetically activated radiation, PAR. These are aerosols that are in the air. When the light comes down, it normally, you know, it has a wavelength that goes downward. Trees, plants have evolved with this kind of direction. Once you have aerosols and particulates in the atmosphere, the light is now diffused in all directions, and this is doing damage to the tops of canopies, something that would never have been thought of. So a surprise effect of having pollution in the atmosphere, because now it's creating a lit environment, which is changing the reproductive areas of trees. And mapping the Amazon basin as a whole intact system. Even though you have eight nations, they all share the same kind of water, same kind of forests, same kind of rivers, and similar cultures. So it's vital that we look at it as a whole system, especially from the World Bank perspective. It's an incredible area. There's so much that's undiscovered. Spectacular place. You walk into that forest and you are truly isolated. You were truly in the element. And if you've not done it before, I highly recommend that at some point in your life, you were alone in a natural element away from people. The interaction is very healthy, and I think it's fantastic to just finally be in a place where you can feel this way and appreciate what that is and recognize that we are part of this system. We are also animals living in this ecosystem. We have to function with that system. We are not in control of nature. We are not in control of nature. It has shown us time and time again that it will find a way. It will find a way around us. We're seeing it with floods. We're seeing it with fires. We're seeing it with increased natural events. Global climate change is real and should be recognized and respected. So when I look at this, I always have an appreciation that there are still places out there unexplored. There's still species to discover. A lot of people think, well, everything's been done, you know. I really want to be a biologist and go do X, Y, and Z. But what's left? There is so much left. There's so many places that you have yet to study. Amazon is just one of them. But you travel around the globe and there's still a lot of spectacular, untouched environments. There's still a lot of hope for the Amazon. And I just really want to thank you for taking that little journey with me. And I'm happy to answer questions at this time.
A member of the audience asked Dr. Valdez to elaborate specifically on the condition of Bolivia.
Well, Bolivia certainly has got itself in a situation. There's a lot of strife sociologically there. Bolivia has an interesting history. You know, it lost its coast to Chile. I think there's a lot in history that is causing a lot of this. But I've not spent a lot of time in Bolivia, but I have a tremendous amount of respect for the people that I've met that come from that country. When you're a poor country like that, it's really hard to consider conservation as an alternative for things. Very hard to be green when you're trying to boost your economy. But I will mention this, though. Even though Bolivia has a lot of political issues going on right now, they do have an incredible Amazon basin. They have incredible resources. The country is fantastic to visit. If you've been to the Andes, the culture, the food, the music is spectacular. So, similar to other countries, I'm always really impressed when I hear about news like this, but you travel there and you see the other side. You see how fantastic it is. And that's the part that I think really just keeps me going, because I know that that's there. But I appreciate that you're keeping up on the news. And yeah, Bolivia is in a very, very fragile state, but I can't really comment on it politically. But I think it's certainly, asking Janine Ferretti from the World Bank, that would be interesting to find out what is going on in Bolivia that would cause changes for their conservation agenda.
A question was asked regarding the amount of dams being built on the Amazon River.
None at all. I'm kidding. No, the thousands. Yeah, it's... No, we've got nothing on South America for dams. It's impressive. Go to Asia, you'll see even more. This is a really dangerous situation in the Xingu River, Xingu Basin, basically, of Brazil. A new dam project came up, and a lot of indigenous peoples were going to be flooded out. Their landscape was going to be changed. They got together. You know, they went and sort of stormed the lectures and the communication going on. Somebody brought out a machete and cut someone. You might have heard of all this in the news. But that's a direct result of a new dam. But there are huge, huge hydrovias and reservoirs and dam projects all throughout the Amazon. But the water eventually still comes in throughout the mouth of the Amazon, which is different from a place like Florida, where you divert it, where it doesn't flow at all naturally. But still, colossal change. But this is where a country gets a lot of its energy. So, but if you go to a place like Costa Rica, you know, they have a few dams there that produce some energy, but it's really a small, small percentage. With a place like Brazil, you know, it's too important. So you will see an increase in these programs, certainly, without a doubt.
Someone invited Dr. Valdez to talk about some of the success stories coming out of the Amazon region.
Well, the success story is that there's still, you know, 3/4 of it remaining. In each country, well, I'll tell you some of the highlights from each of them. For example, in Colombia has its own geographic institute. They do very technical mapping on indigenous peoples. They're paying very close attention to their natural resources. Brazil has its own, they own their own satellites. They have a CBAM program for protecting the Amazon so they can spot a fire instantaneously. Whether they can get to it in time might be a different situation. But they have such fantastic tools for monitoring. They have a division of their government that is looking closely at falsified land claims, because this is apparently a big issue there. You know, a lot of people own land, but they don't really. So learning how that is happening is a major issue, but a success story, because the division is there. The government has changed. The fact that we have an Amazon cooperation treaty is significant. There are numerous protected areas that keep growing. The largest protected area in the world is in the Amazon. So there's a lot of fantastic stuff there. There's a lot of great things that are going on. But I think being proactive and trying to find solutions to the economic barriers is really, that would be more of a success story. And trying to find a way for people to communicate better is still very difficult, especially like indigenous groups who may not speak the same language. So the work that Mark Plotkin does and people like that, bridging these gaps between cultures, at least recognizing that each other exists, there's still an element of fear of sharing information in Latin America. I mean, we've gone through all the countries trying to get them to cooperatively share maps. And, the Latin culture is very welcoming. Oh, of course, we love this. Come, let's go have some food, you know. And then nobody wants to actually give away any information in the end of the meeting. So the fear of relinquishing hard-earned information is still present. So we suggested, well, let's just network everything through the internet. That way no one actually possesses the data, but you can see it on an image. Just give me a picture of where things are. Even that is still a challenge, but slowly changing. But the fact that it's one of the last places on Earth like that, there is tremendous hope and a lot more success stories. But I would rather you get those from some of the people I mentioned, because they spend a lot more time there than I do.
As a final question from the audience, Dr. Valdez was asked to talk more about Costa Rica and their increasing rainforest.
Costa Rica is an interesting case study that you bring up. It appears that it certainly is doing quite well environmentally. There was a time not that long ago where the deforestation rate was highest in Costa Rica than any other country. I've recently was in Costa Rica for a couple weeks. It's changing fast. A nice little place on the beach had 8 cranes putting up condominiums. It's not like it sounds. And, you know, I don't want to, you know, present these negative things to what Costa Rica is trying to achieve, because they have achieved incredible things with ecotourism, of course, trying to get that down to a science and delineate exactly what that is and how you go about managing it. Preserving large areas and preserving the kind of regions that would preserve most biodiversity. And you want north-south kinds of landscapes, not so much east-west. There's a lot of things that they're doing. But I don't think it's, you know, the model. Different countries have different things going on for them. As far as tripling their... No. Now, if you mean designated protected areas, paper parks or something like that, there may be some contribution there. But whenever you hear, oh, they just tripled their... Well, how? What, do they grow it overnight? There's something... It's just the concept of, you know, what does that mean and how is it being termed? And the way things are written and the way things are said are really important. But going to Costa Rica and you drive around and you see nothing but completely developed landscapes for much of it. That's not to say, though, that they don't have spectacular intact forests still in existence, and some of the best ones too. And Costa Rica is an incredibly biodiverse country. You know, you've got these coasts, you've got mountains, rainforests, dry savannas. I mean, it's spectacular. But I would be cautious when you hear about anything about Costa Rica. And the government's website is the best place to go to get actual numbers. And it's very accurate. And they know who owns and who manages every square inch of that country. There is no gray area like there is in Brazil and Peru and these big countries. Costa Rica is black and white, very clear. They know exactly what's going on there. Well, thank you very much for enduring all that.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series. We've heard a presentation entitled Amazon Conservation with Ryan Valdez, a research fellow at the Smithsonian National Zoological Park. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, June 24, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next broadcast in the series will be next Monday, August 18th at 12 noon. At that time, Anthony Seeger, anthropologist, ethnomusicologist, archivist, record producer, and professor from the University of California in Los Angeles will present a program entitled Amazonian Rhythms, Water, Fish, and Indigenous Cultures. More information on other lectures in the Durham Museum series can be found at durhammuseum.org. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.